Okay, we are recording. This is our Ohio Writers Guild, and I know we're saying it's from Ohio, and that's where I am located, and of course that's Sandy and Tim is located there, and Elliot is not. So Elliot is the author of 5 novels: Breakdown at Clear River, Making Arrangements, Fragile Brilliance, Code for Murder, and A Knife's Edge. Wow. He currently teaches English at the University of Mississippi, Old Miss, and he hosts the podcast program Now Appalachia Across Authors on the Air Global Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio, which profiles authors and publishers who live and write about Appalachia. So that is so interesting. I love everything about that. And then, of course, you told me that you had lived for a while in Southern Ohio, which is kind of right in the heart of Appalachia. And so, gosh, tell us about your journey. My first question to you is, what is your backstory? And I see that you teach English, so obviously, you know, there's something there with writing. So tell us about that.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, Kathy, thank you very much for having me, and thanks to the Ohio Writers Guild for having me on as a guest author this month. I appreciate it so much, and appreciate the opportunity very much. But sure, my background, I was born and raised in Charleston, West Virginia. I went to Marshall University, got my undergraduate degree in journalism, worked in journalism for a while, worked for a company called Tri-Cities Media out of Bristol, Virginia. Did that for a while, sort of got out of that line of work when there was a lot of consolidation and corporatization of the media going on. At that time, Clear Channel Radio, who is now iHeartMedia, was going around the country buying up radio stations. And so it just seemed like a good time. The handwriting was on the wall that it wasn't going to be like the way that it was. So I went to graduate school, got my MFA in creative writing at Eastern Kentucky University. Eventually went on and got my doctorate at Murray State. So, you know, English is something that I've always enjoyed. It's the one subject in school I was good in. It was the one subject in school that I really liked. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that, you know, growing up, my mother was a huge reader. I mean, she read all the time, still does. We had books in every room of the house, including the bathroom. And so she was always a big reader. Her parents read to me. My dad's parents read to me. They both read to me. So books and reading and all of that was, a big part of my life growing up. But, I was a journalism major in college, Kathy, and I joined a creative writing club. I had a friend named Zach, who was an English major.
Okay.
And he had started a creative writing club. And I said, well, Zach, I'm not really a creative writer. I mean, I write newspaper stories and press releases and stuff. And he said, look, I don't care. I just need you to show up and keep the chair warm so we can get enough members to get a charter. And I said, be a recognized club. I said, fine, I can do that. Well, long story short, my senior year, we all agreed to work on a story. And there was probably 11 or 12 of us in the club, different genres. You know, some people were just doing this for fun. Some people were a little more serious about it. But anyway, we agreed to work on a piece, workshop it, and send it out for publication consideration by the end of the year. So this was in the era before Submittable, back when you had to get the self-addressed stamped envelopes and all of that.
Oh,
sort of
and
thing.
You're licking the envelopes. And
yes.
Oh my goodness.
The good old days. And so anyway, I had sent a ghost story to a literary journal called Spec at Mary Washington College in Virginia, which I think is Mary Washington University now. And they published it. And that was the
Were
first
you surprised?
I'm totally surprised because I thought, first of all, you know, I know Mary Washington is a very good school, and I thought, you know, that this is a journal that has standards and has expectations, and they're just going to get this little flim-flam ghost story from some kid in West Virginia. They're not going to want to read this. So they published it, and that's really kind of where I started to feel like, you know, somebody might actually want to publish something that I had written creatively. And so I ended up, moving back to the area for graduate school, moved to Southern Ohio, as I was talking about with you earlier before we started. So I lived there for 11 years. I taught English at Mount West Community College for 10 years. I taught at Marshall University for 2 years, and then eventually came down here to the University of Mississippi. So that's really kind of how my writing journey got started. It all started by joining that club accidentally and sending that one short story out for publication. And that's when I got bit by the writing bug, and it's kind of just stuck with me ever since.
Okay, so now that's what motivated you to start. But now what give us some of the logistics around that. I mean, so now you woke up one morning and you said, I think I'm going to write a book. So yeah. How long did that first book take? How did you, you know, how did you come at it, so to speak? We have a lot of newbies in the group. We have some folks that are just starting to write and they're kind of like, I have these stories, they're in my head. How do I get them out on paper? How do I actually turn this into a book?
Sure. That's a great question. And it's something I think in a way, Kathy, everybody kind of has to get through mm-hmm. that themselves. Everybody's path is going to be a little bit different in terms of getting things from that idea stage to the first draft stage to publication stage. For me, my first book was Breakdown at Clear River. That took me about 3 years. Now, I was fortunate in that was my my thesis or my graduating project for my MFA program at EKU, at Eastern Kentucky.
So you did kind of double duty there. You
did a little bit of double duty.
Okay. Yes.
And I had a couple more short stories published. I took some short story workshop courses and I had some more short stories published. And I was working with a writer, a professor there, and a writer. Her name's Amanda Ward. She was one of our professors at the time. She's a New York Times number one bestselling author. She just wrote the book called The Jet Setters, which came out a couple of years ago. And okay. She's got a new one coming out later this year that I've read the arc. You're going to want to read it. It's called The Lifeguards.
Okay. Did
a great story. But anyway, Amanda said, you know, because I told her I wanted to write a novel. I wanted that to be the next step in my writing career, but I had no idea how to do it. And she also teaches a class called How to Write a Novel in a Year. And she offers that several times every okay. year. So you can follow her on Facebook. It's Amanda Ward. I think her maiden name's E-Y-R-E, Ayer or Ire, Amanda Ire Ward. But keep on the lookout for that. It's a great class if you're wanting to try to, you know, get that novel published in a year. But she had told me, she said, you know, I think you're ready to take on the project of writing a novel. And I said, well, I have no idea. How do I start this? How do I transition from short story writing to novel writing? And she said simply, look at it this way. A novel is basically a series of multiple short stories. But instead of having seven different characters in every story, you have sort of the same set of characters. And your chapters in your book, you want to look at it this way. Whatever it is that your character wants, whatever it is that your character is looking for or desires that you set up in chapter one, every single chapter of that novel should be like a short story. And either your protagonist gets closer to accomplishing what it is that they want, or they get pushed back from accomplishing whatever it is that they need or want. And she said, if you look at it that way, if you look at a novel as just a series of smaller short stories around one theme and one set of characters, you know, you can do this, you can do that. And so that stuck with me all through the whole process. And when
this is the first I've heard it framed like that. That's an aha. Yes. Thank you for that.
Oh, absolutely. And anytime I sit down, Kathy, to write a novel now, I think about that. When I think about, well, where am I going to start? Or how am I going to get this character here? Or how am I going to get this character over this plot point to the next plot point? I think about that. I think about, well, what did you tell in the previous short story or chapter one, you know, your little mini short story? What, you know, what did you have there that kept the character from closer to their goal or further away? And so it's been tremendous advice. It's probably the best writing advice I've ever received. I've gotten so much good writing advice from so many authors and professors and everything, but her telling me that a novel was basically just a series of short stories dealing with the same characters is something that has helped me tremendously. So that would be my, and I asked her one time, I talked to her, she did a blurb for my newest book, which is A Final Call, which came out in November. It's a sequel to Code for Murder, the book that you mentioned previously.
Okay.
Amanda blurbed it and read it and blurbed it. And I asked her, I said, can I share your writing advice that you gave me with anybody? She said, yes, yeah, share that far and wide. Tell anybody who wants to know how to do that. So I owe that to her because it just changed my way of thinking. It just changed. It took some of the fear and anxiety mm-hmm. away of tackling a novel. Because the idea, when you look at it on the surface, is overwhelming, but mm-hmm. looking at it from her prism and her advice really helped me kind of break it down into manageable pieces that I could work on.
So where do you get your story ideas? I mean, how did you know that you were ready to sit down on that very first one? How did you know that you were ready to start putting those words on paper, that you actually had the characters? Did you kind of create that ahead of time? And was it running around in your head for a while before you finally started putting it on paper?
Yes, those situations, Kathy, when I have those ideas or those thoughts that just will not get off the back of my mind or get off my subconscious, those typically are the ones that I run with in terms of story ideas. And those are the kind of ideas that when I'm in the shower or when I'm getting ready for work that I'm still okay. thinking about in the back of my mind, or I'm driving to work, or I'm, you know, out cutting the grass or whatever I'm doing. And all of a sudden I think about that character. I think about that idea I'd been mulling over in my mind. Usually that's something that, you know, I usually pursue that because for some reason my mind can't shake that concept or that idea. In terms of ideas, since I write mostly mysteries and thrillers, so, you know, small town newspapers are great places to get story ideas.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, and so, yes. And some of this comes from when I was a journalism major at Marshall, because back in those days, we had a journalism library and we would get newspapers from all over the country that you could go in and check out. Now, oftentimes those newspapers came quite late. You know, we might get the LA Times Sunday paper from 2 weeks ago, but you could still go in and read the LA Times if you wanted to.
Absolutely.
Well, we got, you know, got them from small towns as well. And I was fascinated at looking at some of those small town newspapers, because if you had a murder or a major crime take place in that small town, you know, that was going to be covered in that newspaper from the time the crime was committed all the way up until the trial, through the trial and to conviction.
It gave you a whole storyline.
And through that whole process, you get to know the victim, the families, the sheriff or the detective, the prosecuting attorney, the mayor, the judges, the whole thing. You get this whole rich tapestry of people that do and say things that you can follow along. And so I have used some of that, not a lot, but some of those small town newspaper stories very, very loosely as ideas and fodder. Mm-hmm. For my novels. And so that's kind of really where it starts. I get an idea. If that idea kind of stays with me for a while and I can't shake it, it's on the back of my mind and it pops up at the most inopportune places. That's usually one that I'll go with. And then just kind of following some small town newspapers. And now we can do it online relatively easily. We don't have to have the physical
newspaper. Exactly. Okay. For those of you that are listening, tell me in the chat, where do you get your ideas for your storylines? Just give us some samples of where you might get some ideas. Is it from your grandmother or is it from a newspaper or are you following blogs? Where do you pick up some of your story ideas? So let us know in the chat. You are in the Ohio Writers Guild meetup tonight and we are talking to Elliot Parker and he was giving us some great tips and tricks on some storylines and how he got started. I want to ask you next, Elliot, how do you find time to write? You're teaching, do you have a family or, you know, how in the world do you find the time to actually write? I have a lot of folks that come to me and they go, you know, I've got the ideas. I know the storyline. You know, I know how to put together the story. I just don't have time to sit down and actually write a novel. So how do you create that time for yourself?
Well, when I was living in Southern Ohio and working in West Virginia, the time that I got up and wrote was really early in the morning. Like, you know, 5:30, something like that, before everybody in my house got woken up and before the animals needed fed and watered and walked and all of those things that happens as a part of the morning routine. I was teaching a lot more then, and I had a lot of other responsibilities going on there. I was pretty active in the literary community there in the tri-state area. So that was a pull on my time. Now that I'm at Ole Miss, my schedule is a little more flexible. I'm not teaching quite as much as I was before. So I have more built-in time during the day. I'm not having to get up so early in the morning and write. But basically how I do it, I don't put myself on a word limit or a word count. I know some writers do that. They say, you know, I'm not getting out of this chair until I've written 500 words. I tend to do time limits when I write. I try to give myself at least an hour and a half to 2 hours because I feel like that gives me, you know, time to make progress, but also gives me time to kind of get in the flow of writing and get in kind of that mindset and get into that space of the characters and story that I'm working with. So I give myself between an hour and a half to 2 hours. I try to write 4 or 5 days a week. You know, and some days that's weekends off. Some days that's writing weekends and taking days off during the week. But basically how I do it, Kathy, is I just schedule time in my calendar.
Okay.
You know, I have calendars in our phones and on Outlook. And I use one of those old fashioned at a glance calendars that I can put on the wall and see everything. I'm a very visual person, so I have to see it in front of me. But I just block off time and I'm fiercely protective of that writing time. You know, if I've blocked out, let's say tomorrow from 9 to 11 to write, then from 9 to 11, that's what I do. I turn off the television. I don't take my, I turn my cell phone on silent. I don't, watch television. I that's writing time. And I'm very protective of that writing time. And if somebody says, hey, let's go to breakfast, or hey, you want to go have coffee? And I say, no, sorry, that's my writing time. And I do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, it helps me get into the routine of protecting my writing time. But number two, if you let things eat into that writing time, you won't make the progress that you're trying to make on whatever project it is you're working on, not just a novel, but a short story or a poem or whatever it is that you're working on, because there's so many things that will pull on that time, not just friends, but there will be laundry to do and dishes to wash and grass to cut and cars to wash and all these other adult things that we have, bills to pay, all these other adult things that we have to do. So that's how I do it. I just block off time in the week to do it. I'm fiercely protective of that time. I kind of keep that sacred. And I try to make as much progress as I can. Some days in that 2-hour block, I write 500 words. Some days it's 100 words. Some days it's maybe 50 words. And then I'm kind of thinking in my mind, what am I going to do with this character next? And so it does a lot of different things. It's not always necessarily writing time, but that is my sort of my quote unquote writing time. And I've just found that that's the only way I can do it, because if I wait for the inspiration, or if I wait for the perfect time during the week, it never comes, or there's always something that comes up that pulls on that time. And so,
well, and then weeks go by, and I've had folks tell me that I've been trying to write this book for 10 years. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was thinking about that when I was kind of going over my calendar for tomorrow and the rest of the week, I thought, my goodness, I can't believe it's already mid-March almost.
Yes.
And here at Old Miss, we're at midterm, and we're going to be getting ready for, you know, the end of the semester and graduation and Easter and all these things before you know it. And I swear, it just seems like yesterday I was sitting down and kind of scheduling out my writing time for the semester in January. So you're right. It goes by incredibly fast, whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And you're right. You just have to carve out time and just put it into your schedule, just like you do for work and exercise and fixing dinner and running errands, because otherwise it's difficult to wait for the right moment, because that right moment just doesn't come very often.
Now, some of us might be living in a space that's not all that big. And do you have a private office that you can close the door and write? And if folks don't have that, how do you flag the family's attention that, hey, I'm writing here?
That's a great question. I'm fortunate in that my house has a third bedroom that is kind of a guest bedroom, but it's basically my office.
Okay.
It's down on the first floor, and it's towards the back end of the house. So I can go back there and hide, and you really have to come find me from the living room or from upstairs to track me down. But you know, sometimes I switch it up. Sometimes I will go to somewhere like Panera Bread and write. Sometimes I'll go to a coffee shop and write. I'm in a critique group with three other writers, and sometimes we have what we call working writing meetings once in a while, and we'll just all get together.
I love laptops
and just write for a couple of hours. So I mix it up from time to time, particularly if I feel like I'm in a rut, or I'm, you know, 2 or 3 weeks have gone by and I'm really not making any progress on what I'm trying to accomplish. Then I'll change it up. I'll go to Panera Bread, or I'll call my critique members and say, hey, this Saturday, let's go to Grindhouse Coffee and let's have a writing session for a couple of hours. So that would be my suggestion. If you don't have that designated place, or if, you know, your spouse or your children are always after you, your pets or a combination of all of them that are after you, go somewhere where the ambience is conducive to writing. I know some writers, we don't have a Barnes & Noble in Oxford. We do have one in Tupelo, but a couple of my writer friends that are in my critique group live in Memphis. And there's a couple of Barnes & Noble stores in Memphis where you can go and sit down by the coffee area and write, and they'll go there and write. So, you know, just anywhere you can find that kind of is conducive to writing or kind of puts you in the mindset to write, it is a great way to kind of get around the problem if you don't have a place at home to do it.
I love that. For those of you that are wondering, I do have an expandable screen up behind me, because behind that is my kitchen. I do not have a private office. I work from the corner of my kitchen. I used to have a private office, but for those of you that know me, know that I also teach passive income lanes other than writing, and I teach also about long-term and short-term rentals. And I actually run a bed and breakfast in my home. So I've rented my extra rooms. And so I have moved my office into the kitchen, but it works because it's just me and Mark. And he knows when my screen is up that I am on air. So that's kind of our signal. David says that he gets his ideas, back to that last question in the chat box, that he gets some of his ideas from personal life experiences that shaped his thinking, and also a diary written by someone else. That's kind of interesting. Sandy says, for me, whenever I hear myself say, wouldn't that be interesting if, or I wonder what would happen if, you know what? That's perfect. I love those. Yeah. So thank you for those. Yes. Those are some great tips. Absolutely. Now tell us, overall, do your books flow together? I mean, did you continue on with the characters? I haven't had the opportunity to read your books, but you know, you have five right now, and do they kind of flow together or no?
They do. The Code for Murder and Final Call books are one series, and I've got two books in that series. This book and Code for Murder is set in Cleveland, Ohio, where my dad's family was from. So I've had a longstanding connection to Ohio, even before I lived there in Southern Ohio. And so those two books are set and centered on a female homicide detective named Stacy Tabbitt. In Code for Murder, she is investigating the death of a Cleveland Browns football player. In a Final Call, it picks up a few months after that investigation is concluded, and Stacy is trying to recover physically and emotionally from what she experienced in her last case. And in a Final Call, one of her former college classmates comes to her and says that her son is missing and she wants Stacy's help in finding out what happened to him. Well, long story short, Stacy at first doesn't necessarily think he's really missing. He's just being a young 20-some-year-old son that doesn't want to be nagged by his parents. But then he becomes a suspect in a murder investigation in Cleveland. And so, you know, then Stacy's got to think, well, wait a minute, maybe he is up to something that he shouldn't be doing. So that's that series. My other two books, Fragile Brilliance and A Knife's Edge, those books are set in Charleston, West Virginia, where I grew up. And I have a male detective in that. His name is Ronan McCullough. And he is very much out of place in Appalachia. He is a Boston transplant that sort of left Boston under some difficult circumstances and just basically ended up in Charleston because his truck ran out of gas there. And that's, he just kind of said, and he says in A Knife's or A Fragile Brilliance, he says, yeah, well, you know, I just decided the gas tank went to empties where I would, you know, live my life. And so he ends up in Charleston, West Virginia. So he's got a lot going on. He's gay. He's a gay cop. And so he is involved with his partner. His boyfriend is named Ty Andino, who is a nurse at the hospital in Charleston, which is the Trauma One hospital. So what ends up happening is anytime there are criminals that are brought for treatment because of an investigation, they've been in a shootout or something with police, or Ronan himself specifically, they're brought to the trauma unit and Ty has to interact with them because he's in the emergency room. He's an ER nurse. So long story short, that, you know, Ronan and Ty's personal and professional lives are always intersecting. And Ty does a little bit better job of keeping those separate than Ronan does. And that creates a lot of conflict for them both, you know, in a relationship and also trying to kind of live their professional lives. And so, you know, two different storylines, kind of two different feels to the book. I would say that the Stacy books are a little darker and grittier, a little more noir, if you like that kind of mystery thriller, where there's some dark moments in Fragile Brilliance and A Knife's Edge too, but it's not as, you know, you have a little bit more of a romantic storyline involved in the story, a little bit more about Ronan and Ty's families as they kind of show up periodically and you know, Ronan's trying to keep the secret of their relationship from their families and all of that. And so it's just a different kind of feel, still a mystery thriller, but if you really like the dark, gritty kind of noir style thriller, then the Stacy Tabbitt series might be more to your liking.
Well, I have to ask you this question. Do you know when you start the novel kind of where it's going to land, or does it kind of, or are you as surprised as the reader when you get to the end?
I usually know how it's going to end. I usually know, you know, kind of what Stacy or Ronan's going to go through by the time they get to the end, you know, by the time we identify the crime, by the time we identify the circumstances. I know what they're going to go through and kind of what's going to happen at the end, but I am surprised sometimes. I'm surprised sometimes at, you know, certain scenes that I wanted to be, you know, short, tight scenes end up being a little bit longer because the action or the dialogue there is really important. And mm-hmm. I'm really in a good conversation. And these two characters are really doing and saying things to each other that need to be said. So I'll let that go a little longer. Sometimes I have the opposite happen. You know, I'll have a scene that I thought, man, this thing's going to be a whole chapter long. And then it's a page and a half just because it was wrapped up. It needed to be wrapped up when it happened, or that conversation needed to end when it did. And I'm ready to move on to something else. So yeah, I am a little bit surprised. And that's the great part about being a writer in the creative process is even in your mind, when you have sort of a roadmap, you know, if you give yourself the flexibility to just sort of let things happen as you're telling the story, the surprises are usually unexpected, but they're usually great. I've yes. had more really awesome surprises than I've had surprises where I've thought, ooh, that's kind of lousy. Why did I write that? Why did I put that in there? Usually it's much more positive.
Now, Sandy wants to know, do you approach your stories from a different mindset when you go from a male protagonist to a female one?
Oh gosh, that's a great question. Yes. One of the reasons I wanted to write the Code for Murder Final Call books and have a female homicide detective is to have that experience and that challenge as a male writer of writing from a female perspective. And so, you know, one of the things I've done in those four books, but with the Stacy book specifically, is talk to a lot of female law enforcement officers. Both those that serve on patrol that are just general patrolmen or corporals, and also those that work as detectives. And I've just learned a lot of fascinating details and information from them, particularly, you know, and they're very kind and very honest in answering, you know, because they're still, even though great progress has been made on that end in terms of having a lot of more females in law enforcement, it's still kind of a male dominated profession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women serving in those roles, it depends from department, you know, small town departments with female officers and detectives respond differently than a major metropolitan force like Cleveland. But, you know, some common threads emerged. And one of the things I learned from talking with some of those female officers is that they get much more emotionally invested and emotionally connected to the characters and the and victims and the family members. Not that the male detectives and officers I talk to don't, but they're able to compartmentalize it really well. I talked to a female homicide detective in Southern Ohio about 3 or 4 years ago, and she said, I haven't slept more than 4 hours a night for 20 years. And I said, well, can you elaborate on that? And she said, you know, all I do is think about, you know, the cases I'm working on, the families, the victims. And then, you know, then when I'm done with that, I'm thinking about the ones from 2 and 3 years ago. I just can't, wow. I just can't shake that. And so
they don't let it go as quickly.
They don't let it go as quickly. Yes. And they think about, you know, if it's a crime, for example, involving a teenage son and it leaves the mother, you know, behind, and the mother's the only, you know, that was the only child, you know, I've had a detective tell me, she said, you know, I think about that mother a lot, or if I'm driving through that neighborhood where the crime mm-hmm. happened, I think, well, I wonder how Jane's doing today. It's been 3 years since her son was killed. You know, I wonder if, you know, that kind of thing. They tend to have that carry on their conscience a lot more from what I was able to find out than the male detective. So I had to work a lot of that into the storyline. One of the questions I get, Kathy, to kind of play off her question, you know, one of the questions people will ask me sometimes is, what's the difference between Stacy and Ronan? They're both homicide detectives. One's in a big city, one's in a smaller city. You know, how are they different? Well, and this comes back to kind of the original question about writing from a female perspective.
Okay.
Stacy is much more collaborative and much more cooperative and much more trusting of her colleagues and her captain and her partner and sort of the justice system, the structure of the justice system. She believes in it, and she's much more willing to acquiesce and to bring them in and tell them everything that's going on. Ronan is not that way. Ronan is very much kind of suspicious of bureaucracy that exists okay. within law enforcement. He's someone who, if he gets a gut instinct, he goes with it. He doesn't okay. necessarily tell his captain or his partner or his unit, hey, I've got this hunch, I'm going to pursue it. He just does it. and then kind of operates under the, well, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission concept, which gets him into all kinds of trouble because he's kind of going on a rogue streak or rogue.
Yeah, but what a great storyline, because you can take that so many different directions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's something too I learned in talking with some female law enforcement officers too, is that the general sense I got from talking to several of them is that they are much more willing to kind of work within the confines of the structure of the department or the structure of the unit that they're in, and be much more collaborative, where some of the male officers I talked to kind of were like, yeah, if I have a hunch and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to go for it. I'm not going to wait till the captain comes in at 7 to start his shift or her shift or whatever. I'm going with it. And so I try to work some of that into the Stacy books as well. So you see some of that, which makes her different from how Ronan behaves in a lot of his circumstances.
Well, Sandy says, thanks. She can see the difference now, and she appreciates that you focus on such details, whether they appear in the story or not. So you have to have this clear vision of who this person is as you start to write, and what their personality type is and how they do respond to things. Do you find as you're writing that maybe you make that personality a little more edgy as you're writing?
I do. I think so. And I think that, you know, depending on the circumstances you put your character in, or in this case, Stacy, the circumstances, or how much pushback she gets. And we were talking earlier about, you know, every chapter in a novel is kind of like a short story, and
right.
your character either gets closer to getting their want or need, or gets pushed back farther. Well, depending on how often and how severe Stacy gets pushed back, it does kind of leave her with a little bit of a hard edge. And one of the things we see in A Final Call, you know, I firmly believe too, just as sort of a side note, if you're writing a series, this is a challenge to writing a series for me personally. You want your character to have some of those core values and personality traits that you were talking about, Kathy, but you also don't want them to be the same at the end of book two as they were at the end of book one. And so one of the things we see in A Final Call, for example, with Stacy, is that she does get a little more edge to her, and gets a little, I don't want to say harsher and nastier, but she's more willing to call out people for not doing what they're supposed to do in A Final Call than maybe she did in Code for Murder. She still works within the structure of the department, is still collaborative, and still reaches out to her colleagues and the prosecuting attorney's office and all of that when she needs to. But there's several scenes where she feels like her partner, for example, Austin Serrera, is not pulling his share of the weight, or he's kind of dragging his feet on certain things in the investigation that needs to be done. And she just calls him out on it. She just says, look, you're not working fast enough. Or she has one scene kind of middle of the book where they're kind of standing by the cubicle of desks, and the captain's there and everybody's kind of clustered around, and she just berates him for getting something wrong, or not asking a question, I think it was, of a witness, a key witness that they're trying to investigate. He comes back later, and then he kind of disappears for a couple of days, a couple of chapters. You don't hear from him. And he said, you know, I don't appreciate how you dressed me down in front of the captain and in front of my colleagues. You know, I've been here as long as you have, and no one should deserve to be, you know, talked to like that in front of their colleagues and their supervisor. So she gets a little harder edge to her in this book. But again, that is a result of kind of the pushback she's getting from trying right. to find out, you know, what Monica DeVito's son Colton was up to. What, you know, did he commit this murder? What's he really involved in?
Yeah, that's all out of her frustration. Yes,
it is. And so she's a very different character by the end of A Final Call than she was at the end of Code for Murder. But she's still got those core traits. And I think that's really important if you're writing a series and you're going to keep this, particularly if you're going to keep this character for several books, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 books, you know, you want to see more of their personality emerge, and you want to see how they handle and react to the stress and the pressure mm-hmm. that you put them through and stress you put them under. But they've got to have those core values that made readers fall in love with that character to start with, because that's what's going to keep a reader hooked in and engaged and keep them reading, is they know that Stacy's going to, when all else fails, she's going to do X, Y, and Z things, even if she has moments where she's, you know, not real happy with people and not real happy about what's going on.
You know, I'm excited. I can't wait now to read. I'm an avid reader. I think oftentimes writers are readers, and we have the love of books. Like you said, you had books everywhere in your house. I do too. I've got books everywhere. I've got them here next to my computer. They're next to in the TV room. They're in the bedroom. I've got books everywhere. And so I get that. And I'm excited now to read your books. You know, I feel like I've gotten just enough of a sneak peek that it has really sparked my interest. So my question is, when you're writing your books, do you have a picture of who your audience is going to be as you're writing? I would think at some level you would, so that you would know at what level to, you know, to write. How did you determine who your audience was going to be before you started writing these books?
That's a great question, Kathy. In a little sort of humorous manner, one person I think of in my mind, in my picture frame when I'm writing, is my mom, because she's a voracious reader. She's retired now. She was a nurse. She was an emergency room nurse. So, you know, I base a lot of Ty and Dino's circumstances in the Rhoda McCulloch books based on kind of what she experienced. Well, she's retired now. So she reads three and four books a week. And she's always telling me, oh, you know, Elliot, I'm reading this new series by so-and-so. Have you started that? And I'm like, well, no, Mom, I'm working on a manuscript and I got papers to grade and class to teach and all that. And she's like, well, you need to get on that as soon as possible. So, but she's also a very smart reader, and she is very good at picking up things in stories and knowing if this writer just doesn't quite have a handle on the plot. So I think about her a lot of ways, because she has read some of my books or some of my early drafts of manuscripts and been like, that red herring just doesn't work. I figured out that it wasn't that 3 chapters ago. You got to ditch that. Yeah, she's a lot nicer than that, obviously. But so I think about her in mind. But, you know, basically, you know, I have done a lot of research on this. I've read a lot of articles on this, that a lot of mystery and thriller, a majority of mystery and thriller readers are women between the age of, let's say, 28 and 65. That's kind of the sweet spot for people that read mysteries and thrillers mostly. So I keep that in mind when I'm writing. That's that, you know, and I also know that, having done some research on this, that that age range, female writers like to have some familial elements involved or woven into the story, and sometimes a little romance worked in there as well. And I was talking about the Ronin series earlier being a little different than the Stacy series. It's got that in it. It's got the romance story between Ronin and Ty, and it's got some of their family members who pop up now and then, usually at the most inopportune times, and they've got to deal with that. So I keep that in mind. You know, I try not to write to trends specifically, you know, because, you know, what might be trendy now, by the time you finish a draft in 9 months or a year from now, may not be trendy anymore. But one thing I've learned, you know, about that picture frame reader is, if you're writing mystery through, I mean, this is true of all genres, but if you're writing mysteries and thrillers, these are very smart readers. Mystery and thriller readers tend to be very voracious in not only reading that genre, but other genres as well. And they're really smart and they're really good. And like my mom, they can figure out if you've got holes, you know, in your plot, or if you've got a character that's just not going to be able to carry the story forward for 250 or 300 pages. And so,
how do you keep track of those characters and build out those storylines? And you know, I always struggle when my character does something here, I have to make sure that I remember that 10 chapters later. And how do you keep all of that straight in your writing? Do you have a platform you use? Do you do it on paper? Doing your work on a cork board? I mean, it's all different ways work for a lot of different authors. What works for you?
Well, I'm pretty visual. I'm a really visual person. And so I have to see it, always have been. I have to see it in front of me to kind of, you know, absorb it and process it. I've tried some of those computer programs, Kathy, Scrivener and some of those others, and it's functional, but it's too complicated. And I waste a lot of time. You know, it's almost, Scrivener to me is like 35 Excel spreadsheets built into a database, and you're clicking cells and dragging cells and clicking here and highlighting this. And I just waste way too much time with that. And I tried that a couple of years ago. Someone got me a subscription, or a trial subscription, as a Christmas gift. And I fooled with it for 30 days or a month and a half or something like that. I just couldn't. I was wasting way too much time trying to make sure I had everything in every cell populated. And it was
okay.
So I went back to my tried and true method, which is I just use a big post-it note board.
Okay.
And I'm on first name basis with our good friends here at Office Depot in Oxford, because I'm in there all the time buying post-it notes. And I have color post-it notes. You know, pink is for characters, green is for setting, Blue is for plot points. Red is for antagonists. Purple might be for minor characters.
Okay.
And so I'm just all constantly moving those around. And that helps me kind of linearly see where I am. And then as things are done, as things are accomplished, I can pull those post-it notes off and I can say, okay, I've dealt with, if the purple column, for example, is gone, and my poster board's too big to show you, but if my purple column is gone, for example, then I know, okay, I've dealt with my minor characters. Everybody's been established and introduced. Everybody is, you know, been known to the reader. So I'm done with that. Or, if I've got four or five green post-it notes still there, then I know I've got a little bit more work on the setting to do.
Okay.
In terms of making it. So that's how it works for me, because I can move things around. I can see where I am, but I can also kind of have that sense of accomplishment when I pull those sticky notes off the board. Then I'm like, okay, I'm making some progress here. I'm done with this column for now. Now I've got to work a little more over here. So I know that's very old fashioned and kind of seems silly in a way.
No, but, I get it. It I get it. Me. I get it. So don't laugh. I'm taking this off of my wall right now.
Perfect. I have to have that. I have to have that visual. And I feel bad because I've kind of disparaged Scribner, I think it was, but yeah, I've just got to see it in front of me. I just have to. And
well, for those of you that are listening, the right answer is whatever works for you.
Right.
Yeah. The right answer is whatever works for you, whatever it is that you can use that works for you. David had asked how you keep track of all of those characters and do you use a software program? And it's just whatever really works for you. And because I get inspired at all different kinds of places, I, you know, make notes in my phone. I've got notes everywhere. So when I get back to my office or my little corner of the kitchen, then I have to kind of get those organized. So yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
So
I have some writer friends that love Scrivener. I mean, they swear by it. They said it's made them a more productive writer, a better writer, a faster writer. So I don't mean to kind of, you know, throw that out and say but it just didn't work for me. So you're right, Kathy. Find something that works for you, no matter how old fashioned or new age it might seem, and just go with it.
I love it. I love it. This conversation has been so good. I just really enjoy talking with you and hearing about how you got started, your backstory, and how you came through writing this many novels. Kudos to you. I love that. I want to share with our readers, you can touch base with Elliot by just going to elliotparker.com. ElliotParker.com. So everybody make a note of that. You can see his name there in his little square as you see us on the Zoom call. And Elliot only has one L. So that's probably the biggest problem is that folks try to spell your name Elliot with two L's. So ElliotParker.com. You can see all about him, his books, his workshops, news and events, and also his podcast. So you can connect with him in numerous different ways. And for those of you that are interested in connecting with me, kind of the same answer, you go to kathybinner.com. And if you'll scroll down my homepage, you will come to the Ohio Writers Guild free meetups, and you'll find all of our replays there. So everyone that we had a chance to interview, their free replay will be there. And so we probably have several authors on the call as well. And so I will mention to you, if anyone is interested in being interviewed on this particular channel, you can certainly contact me again through kathybinner.com. And what is in it for you is that once we complete this call, I will send you the actual link. I'll send you the embed code and you can use it in any portion of it or in its entirety. If there's a section you want to clip out and use it maybe on a speaker page or whatever you want to do, you can use parts and pieces of this video however you see fit that works for you to help market your books. So please contact me and Elliot will get all of that later this evening or tomorrow morning, depending on how quickly I get around to getting it out there, because I've got another call after this one. So it might be tomorrow morning before I send it over to you, Elliot. But anyway, so that's what you get if you do want to be interviewed. So just contact me. Just connect with me through kathybinner.com. Connect with Elliot through elliotparker.com. And Elliot, one last question. What are your plans for the future? Where are you going with all of this? So do you have a big audacious plan out there?
Well, I do. I can officially share some good news. Well, first of all, let me on the writing side, I'm working on a third book in the Ronan McCullough series. It's tentatively called Double Crossed.
Okay.
I'm about 70. Well, I've got about 15,000 more words. I'm kind of in the final third of the book. I hope to have it finished, at least the first draft finished by the spring.
Okay.
And the catch for it, the reason it's called Double Crossed is because everybody in the book's double crossing everybody else. And so that's going to be you got to find out who's really, and Ronan gets involved in some double crossed. And so you got to find out, you know, who's telling the truth, who's lying, how many people are being lied to by whom, and all of that. So that's
okay.
I'm looking forward to that. I've got sort of the outline briefly of the next Stacey Tabbitt book. Because I ended a final call with a little bit of a cliffhanger. I've got some ideas for where I'm going to go next with her. I can mention this too, that Filmways Pictures in California has acquired the rights to Code for Murder.
And wow.
They are in the process of doing a screenplay and a pitch kit.
Was your fourth book though, wasn't it?
Yes, that was. That
okay.
was.
And okay. Okay.
So, they've done the poster and the press release and all that. They're finishing up the screenplay and they hope to have it. They've got 25, what they told me today, 25 film companies interested in producing it. And so they're going to pitch that this summer, I guess, when all the film companies start picking up their projects for 2023, which is a little, I think I'm speaking about this correctly. It's about the same time when networks start determining what TV shows are they going to renew uh-huh. for the next year. It's around that same time frame. So hopefully later this summer, early in the fall, we'll have a producer or, you know, a film company or two identified and some more information to share. So I'm pleased at that. How that happened is.
I was going to say, did you ever dream that this would happen?
No, never in a million years. I just thought, you know, if 10 people read my book and liked it, that would be good enough for me. But the book was displayed. It came out in 2017. And of course, you know, COVID and everything put mm-hmm. everything behind. But the last time that the LA Times Book Festival was in California before COVID and under normal circumstances, the book was featured there as it was on a display. And somebody from Filmways came by, picked it up, read it, loved it. And that's kind of how it all started. So this really started about a year ago, kind of when COVID was still, they okay. reached out to me about a year ago. And so I was told that I couldn't say anything about it until we got a little further along. And I was told today I could say something about it. So I'm
inspired.
Like, it's perfect. I was like, and I said, this is great. I'm doing an interview tonight. So I'm going to mention it. So I'm real excited and I'll keep you and the guild posted on how things go.
Yes.
But for now we're kind of in a holding pattern with, you know, for more announcements until summer or fall, late summer, early fall, about that, but I'll keep you guys informed, but I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that someone thought enough. And it's going to be great for Cleveland because we're going to get to, you know, have Stacey there and we're going to show Cleveland and we're going to have the Browns involved. It'll be a lot of fun. Plus the murder and mayhem that goes along with it. So I'm real excited and really honored to have the opportunity. So I'm looking forward to sharing Stacey with everybody kind of in a different medium later on. So
I love that. Sandy says congratulations. And yes, thank Elliot, you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
I'm looking forward to connecting more with you. So if you are in the Ohio area, visiting Cleveland or wherever you are in Ohio, I personally am just right outside of Columbus, Ohio, and I do have a guest house, a bed and breakfast right here in my home. So you are welcome to come and visit and stay. I would love to meet you. This has been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being here this evening. I can't wait to see what you're going to do next.
Thanks, Kathy. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks to everybody for joining, and thanks for all the great questions. Really appreciate it. And please feel free to reach out anytime if you just want to talk about writing or if you want some tips. I don't know what tips I could give you, but I'd be happy to share anything that I might know with you. So again, just thanks so much, and thanks to the Writers Guild for what you all do for supporting writers in Ohio. It really is important, and it does make a difference.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate you being here. Does anyone have any questions for Elliot before we go? We've been kind of fielding questions as we go along, but if anyone has any final questions or comments, you can drop those in the chat. Again, you can connect with Elliot. Just go to elliotparker.com and you can see his books, his workshops, his news, events, his podcast. And then he also has a way there that you can connect with him if you want to. And Tim says it was a great interview. Yes. Thank you, Tim. Thank you for being here with us. And again, go to kathybinner.com, scroll down to the Ohio Writers Guild free meetup, and you can find all of our replays. And I'll put the connect in there as well on how you can reach Elliot. And I'll also put a reference in there about Amanda Ward. That was a good little tip. So I'll mention that as well.
She's a great writer. You'll love everything that she has written. She's just a wonderful, wonderful storyteller and a great person.
Good, 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 good. Again, thanks for being here. And with that, we're going to sign off. And everyone, please join us again. It's the second Tuesday of every month at 6:30. Put it on your calendar. And same link that you use today, we keep the same link every month. And so just sign in each month. We'd love to have you. And we'll talk to everyone soon. Thank you so much. We're getting byes and great interview. And Elliot, again, thank you. And you'll be getting an email from me later tonight or tomorrow.
Sounds great, Kathy. Thanks again for everything. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.